Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the top comic sales through Diamond to retailers for February 2020. And as always, this is what goes through Diamond into stores, not what sells out to the readers and stuff like that. And because we're a little behind and things are happening in the world on a fairly frequent basis, I'm just going to say flat out, we're recording this on Tuesday night, May 31st. It's probably going to be another week or two at least before it goes up, and a bunch of stuff will have changed by then, no doubt. So if our information and our opinions feel a little dated, it could be because they are.
It's only March 31st there, John, not May.
Oh, I'm
not
sorry.
Not that bad yet.
Sorry. Time is in such a flux these days. You're right. It is May or March 31st. There, I just about did it again. Jeez. It's a bad way to start off. Now, the data for February, the COVID-19 pandemic was happening in the world. It was not happening in the United States, so people were starting to become aware of it, but I don't think, in my opinion, it really impacted the February sales. Now, I did put together another spreadsheet, just kind of an ad hoc one, where I split stuff out by the solicitation month, the final order date, the first shipping date, and the publisher for the full top, 500 and some odd items I've got, just so we can kind of prove out that theory. And so we can see kind of the shape of the data, because I do think when we get around to looking at the March data, that kind of a breakdown is going to be really important. Because we went from the beginning of March, where it's like, yeah, this coronavirus is a thing, to here we are at the end of March. There are shelter in place, stay at home, lockdown orders, the name of them varies a little state to state, community to community. But there are somewhere over 200 million people, I think, impacted by these things. We've got printers shut down. We've got Diamond suspending new sales. We've got, stores shut down, people out of work. And that evolution all happened in March. So I'm looking at the February data with kind of a pre-pandemic viewpoint with a question of how does it situate the market going into this? Are we starting from a robust place? Are we not? And then, man, when we look at the March data, presuming it gets released, I'm curious what kind of a picture that paints, and really curious what the next set of data would be after that, with, of course, no new comics shipping at all in print in April. So the top 300 was down almost 400,000 units. It was actually closer to 399 units and, I don't know, 80-something or whatnot. So down a little bit, it was the 11th worst month since invoice sales started being reported in February 2003. February of 2019 was the most recent month that was worse. Prior to that, we've got to go all the way back to early 2011. And at that point, January, February, April, and May were all worse. And that March wasn't a whole lot better, but it was a little bit better. Because we wound up at just a little over 5.4 million units for the top 300 this month. And if we do the breakdown of that, 49.68% of the units was Marvel. That's not too surprising. 34% even to DC. 4.77% of the units to Image. And then 2.56% to Boom, and another 2.56% to IDW, 2.08% to Dynamite, and then 1.46% to Dark Horse, leaving out of, again, the top 300 sales, 2.98% split by Valiant, Aftershock, Titan, Oni, Vault, Archie, Benitez Productions, Ablaze, Albatross, Coffin, Abstract, and Action Lab. So we've talked a lot about this sort of a breakdown and stuff, but I think it really shows that we've got a couple of really big publishers, Marvel and DC. I mean, that's no surprise. Everyone, I think, knows that. But then the relative size of these other publishers. And I think over the last week or two here in March, the size of the publisher and, you know, kind of mandated to me the speed of response, if you will, or the visibility or the importance of the response, I guess is the better way to say that. We're going into a very weird situation. Marvel controls roughly half the sales, so what they have to say really matters, whereas, you know, what Archie or what Aftershock or what Valiant does, I'm curious about it, and I think it's important, but it's not going to have as big of an impact on the industry as what Marvel, DC, or Image, or some of these other publishers do. Would you guys kind of agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the larger part you play, obviously, the more eyes are on your announcements. I think that what Marvel, and maybe DC and Image to a certain extent, were doing was looking to see what other publishers were going to decide to do and what the reactions were going to be. I think Image was one of the first ones to actually get out there and kind of put their flag in the ground and say, this is what we're planning to do. At least, you know, everything's fluid. So at that point in time, that was their decision. And then Marvel followed up with some a few things, and it was basically crickets from DC.
Yeah, and I think that was unfortunate.
Well, but Image was in a weird and unique position. They made a bunch of announcements that affected them not at all.
Well, I think Image is always in a bit of a unique position because of the Image Central line, how it's kind of an umbrella publisher for a lot of its stuff. Really, the importance of the individual studios, I don't think, is that big today compared to where it was, you know, 10, 20 years ago and stuff. So that did free them up to make some decisions that might have been harder for other publishers. And also, they don't have kind of the corporate structure above them that both DC and Marvel have.
Yeah, I know Image got praised for their announcement, but I looked at it and went, that was such a nothing announcement for them to make. They really went, hey, we're doing all these things. You notice the one thing they didn't mention in there is any waiving of their Image fees. They're like, oh, we're going to take books, we're going to do all these things, make us look good and screw over the creator that already paid us. We're not actually going to affect that. We're going to affect everything they can make back. I thought it was the worst announcement of all.
I guess I would say if that's all the announcement is, then it's a pretty bad one. I would like to hope that there was internal announcement to creators, because the announcement that came out from Image was basically through Diamond to retailers. So it was a retailer-oriented message, not so much a creator-oriented message, but to your point, if that's all it is, then it's pretty easy for them to play with other people's money.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's less risk for them. Flip side, we don't know how dependent Image is on that Image fee. In other words, do they have stuff that could carry them through a couple of months? Do they not? And does it do the creators any good if, for some crazy reason, Image is on, which I doubt, on a month-to-month kind of a basis where they don't get that money in, they're in trouble? It wouldn't do anybody any good for Image to shut down. Not that I think there's any risk of that either. But to your point, I do think some publishers have made statements that were good public relations, but not really particularly meaningful statements or stands. Whereas a few others, I think, came out of the gate earlier than others on, yeah, we're not going to do digital releases in April, or, you know, we're going to do discounting, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that to try to help out their retail partners. But I do think, again, the importance on some of that is, again, directly relative to, you know, what amount of the sales that the individual publisher is kind of accounting for. And this is one of those cases where I do think that conceptually, if we could somehow work this, we'd be better off if there were a lot of publishers that were on a more even footing versus having two that are at this, you know, 30 to 50% range, another five or so that are in this 1 to 5, maybe 10% range on a good month, and then everybody else who's, you know, doing good to get a fraction of a percent. You know, just distributing the risk around to different publishers and stuff seems like it would be a good thing. Not going to happen. That's just not the way the industry is structured, and it kind of favors the already successful. So unless something radical changes, I don't think we're going to see a major shifting and evening out of these percentages of the top 300 units across publishers. If we start looking at the top comics itself, though, what I'm seeing here paints a little bit of a disturbing picture in my mind. First off, the good news. We had a really strong item at the top of the list. We had a Wolverine number one, 190,568 units. That's great. That was nearly, you know, 200,000 units, so good on them. Now, We all know that it's a Marvel first issue. It's not indicative of how the title's going to sell. When it hits a second issue, it's going to do way worse. But it's at least a strong item at the top of the list. The next two items were also Marvel titles. It's X-Men number 6, followed by number 7. Number 6 did 92,287 units. 7 did 76,691 units. So a 16.9% drop between those two. It's like, okay, the X-Men Dawn of X stuff is finishing up its first arcs. It's getting out of that honeymoon period and stuff like that. We knew it was going to cool off and stuff. But neither of those hit over the 100,000 mark, which, okay, not too surprising. Hard to sustain over 100,000, although I thought X-Men had a shot. But for it to be getting down to under 77,000 by that seventh issue and is the third item on the list, again, February, typically kind of a down month. We did see overall sales down here, so I'm not expecting everything to be doing great, but three items down and we're well under 80,000. That's not a great position to be in.
And mostly $5 books.
X-Men 6 was $3.99, X-Men 7 was $4.99, and we're followed by a couple of other $4.99s. I agree that the $4.99 price point does not increase sales.
And the number one book's an $8.99 book.
Yet it was still number one.
Yes, but you look at the top 10, let's say. It's kind of what we've always seen. It's the X-Men are a little new, but other than that, it's Batman, Spider-Man, and a bunch of Marvel number ones. And now the Marvel number ones are all $5 instead of $4. And one of them is $8.
You can certainly argue it's what we've always seen in that respect, and I'm not going to disagree with that. Where I think it's a little different than what we typically see is if you look at the top 10,
mm-hmm.
those are the only things over 55,000 units.
Yep.
That's where I start to get a little concerned. You know, we're only those top two items better than we were doing back at the beginning of 2011, which is what prompted the whole New 52 reboot over at DC. They saw that there was an apathy on their material and stuff, and they figured they had to do something serious to shake it up. And I definitely think that there's some great stuff coming out these days. I think, you know, the X titles are certainly among them, but we're not seeing crazy robust sales even at the top of the list.
Well, and we've often hypothesized that the general comic reading audience is a certain size and they have a general budget. And when you just increase everything by 20%, like Marvel has done with a lot of the books at the top, that's going to affect everything below it. Because for every one of those that's sold, it's a quarter of a book that's coming off someplace else, potentially.
So you're suggesting that even though the units are down, the dollars could be roughly equivalent?
I haven't looked at it that way, but it's entirely possible. Let's see.
It's certainly a good theory. It doesn't happen to be the case here because we're down about 1.3 million from last month.
We are, and we're roughly, but again, if you go back and compare it to a year ago, we're down less than 40,000 units, but we're up over $1.6 million.
Yeah, and I certainly think the increased cover price, you know, explains that.
And this is always the dead part of the year.
Yeah.
January, February are always low. Mid-February is where you start to see a rise.
Which is why I went back to last February.
Right, right.
And we even talked about it a month ago. And we talked about how January and December kind of mirrored last year. They kind of flip-flopped. Last year, I think December was a little better than January, and this year it was the opposite. But if you combine the two, they were almost mirror images. And same thing, February, again, we're almost exactly on par with last February. But, you know, like you point out, the cover price average is up significantly, particularly if you do that as a weighted average. With all these $5 books, $10 books, $8 books, $7 books, and particularly with so many of them being top 10, a weighted average is the cover dollars are hugely up.
Do you guys think that the publishers, because I know in light of the whole, you know, pandemic and stuff, a lot of publishers saying, hey, we're going to, you know, look at our schedule and adjust it accordingly and try not to, you know, overwhelm the market with frankly, a lot of stuff that maybe we don't need. Do you think they're going to take a look at the price point and determine if they want to keep doing these $7.99, $8.99, $9.99 books, or even as many $4.99 books for that matter?
Eric, what do you think?
I don't think they're really going to change much, to be quite honest.
I agree with Eric.
I think the things that are changing are, you know, Marvel extending a deeper discount to retailers, returnability. I think they're more apt to go in that direction and let retailers make the decision if they want to pass some of that savings on. Their plan behind this ultimately is to keep the flow of their books in the stores and try not to bury the retailer.
Yeah, I guess it's just that we've seen a couple of publishers, and I'm thinking like Boom specifically here, where they've kind of pulled back over the last year or so the amount of material they're kicking out in an attempt to be able to focus a little bit more on the books they're doing, have those individual books do better so they're not necessarily losing sales. But again, they're not flooding or smothering the market. And I'm wondering, given people getting laid off or losing their job entirely or whatever, if we're going to have a much more price-conscious readership and if the publishers respect that at all. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just trying to do a quick look and see, because Boom did ramp down their production a little bit, but I feel like they've been expanding it again, adding in some of the new titles that tend to be some of their best moving titles. Yeah, I think ultimately those plans that Boom had made were formed before the coronavirus even mm-hmm. hit. Right, this was just part of their operating plan. And if I had to read into it, I think the reason they did it was because they do offer some pretty strong returnability on their titles for the first couple issues, and sometimes randomly in between if they know there's going to be a new story arc. And so I think the way that they're looking at it is, if they reduce the amount of titles they have ongoing, that kind of mitigates or offsets potentially some of the loss by doing some returnability, because you're focusing on a smaller set of books and reducing risk across the board. But at the same time, they also had some pretty significantly underperforming books that were coming out. And for them to be a premier publisher and to only do, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 copies for a book, you know, one or two books is okay. But if you're going to do that across your entire line, that's not the best. So I think it was just a conscious business decision that had some nice PR spin to help kind of, you know, lessen the blow. And it did help. It definitely helped. But I think really, you know, I think even comparing Image, it doesn't work. It's basically Marvel, DC, and the rest, right? Marvel and DC's decision-making tree is incredibly different than anyone else's. And Image is kind of unique as well. But, you know, Marvel and DC are just a small speck on these mega corporations that they have to abide by mega corporation policy, but they're also the biggest in this industry. So they can't be nimble or as nimble as, you know, like a Scout or an Aftershock. But yet their decision makes huge impacts across. So I don't think you can compare the publishers at all in that regard.
I would agree with that. I think just because of the corporate structure, the size of the lineups at Marvel and DC, it's a bigger ship to try to turn than, frankly, most of the other publishers. You know, most of them have a clear, you know, hey, if Mike Richardson says this is what's going to happen, that's what Dark Horse is doing. You know, and there's the same over at a lot of these other publishers. There's a decision maker or two that have to be consulted, and what they say goes, for good or ill. And I think most of the publishers seem to be, I think, reacting well to the pandemic stuff. I just think that part of it is, again, Q1 of any year is sluggish sales, but we're seeing a lot of really sluggish sales, and it wouldn't take too much of a percentage hit kind of across the board, even, you know, a 10 or whatever percent hit for some of these sales to get to the point of, are these titles continuing to be viable? And we're a small enough industry that if a store goes under, that impacts Diamond, that starts to impact publishers. If publishers start having problems, that impacts the retailers and stuff. It reverberates back and forth and can do that fairly quickly. So I'm hoping we're not getting into a position where we've got sluggish sales that are bolstered by heavy use of variant incentive covers and such, that the market is just potentially going to find itself unable or unwilling to support. And I don't know if that's going to be the case. Maybe people are going to say, you know what? All this stuff is just driving me nuts. I'm going to lean heavy into my comic collecting just to get away from it all. Maybe people can do that. I don't know. So the other items we've got near the top of the list, we've got a Gwen Stacy number one, we've got a giant size X-Men Jean Grey and Emma Frost number one, a Star Wars Darth Vader number one, an X-Men Fantastic Four number one. Most of these, well, like the giant size X-Men's a series of one-shots that are all going to be first issues. Star Wars Darth Vader's an actual ongoing, I believe, but the X-Men Fantastic Four is a miniseries. Is Gwen Stacy a miniseries or ongoing?
I believe it's a miniseries. I thought it was a 6-issue.
What am I saying? It's Marvel. Whether it was announced as such, it's probably a miniseries anyways. That distinction really doesn't hold as much these days or not. But even so, none of them, including the giant-size X-Men Jean Grey and Emma Frost, did, you know, astoundingly well. The Gwen Stacy did 68,348 units. And I'm willing to bet not only will the next one not do as well, but that this one did that well because of a plethora of variant covers.
I lied, John.
Huh.
It's not a 6-issue miniseries.
Five?
It's a 5-issue miniseries, yeah.
Yeah. And it had a 1 in 25 cover, a 1 in 50 cover, a couple of signed covers. So yeah, they had some incentives behind that.
Yeah, the signed ones came from Dynamic Forces, but it had an Adam Hughes A cover, which was one of the bigger ones. And then it also had a J. Scott Campbell variant, which is obviously another big one. The only thing they were missing was Archer, and they had the trifecta.
Surprised they didn't go for that.
If they'd had that, it probably almost would have doubled the sales on it.
Yeah, actually, now that I'm looking at the right spot on my spreadsheet, I'm seeing a 1 in 25, a 1 in 100, a 1 in 200, a connecting Chinese New Year variant. I mean, they don't really hold back with variant covers at Marvel at all.
Nope.
I hope if they are reliant on that model that the market can continue to support it.
Well, if you look at how a lot of their like 1 in 200 and 1 in 100 type stuff is working, the 1 in 200 is a virgin cover of the Ji Hyung Lee variant. So that's art they already have. They just take the masthead off. And then the 1 in 100 is a Romita Sr. hidden gem. And the hidden gem variants are all just old stock art from the artists that they pull out. So no new cover being made there. So they're putting in some pretty high ratio books with little to no additional cost to them. So it's really clever on their part.
Yeah, yeah. Whoever came up with taking the logos and stuff off and calling that a virgin cover and charging more for it, that was brilliance.
It's, you can thank retailers for that.
Yeah. I always get a kick out of the blank variant.
Yes.
We won't put anything on there and we'll charge more for it.
Well, my favorite is they just, I think it was in the last FOC before the big Corona shutdown, they had there was a Hulk blank variant. It was a purple one, I want to say. It was either purple or green, and it was a 1 in 200 to get a blank variant.
Yeah, that's insane. But
someone's getting it. You know someone's going to get it.
Yeah, it works.
Right.
So until it stops working, they're not going to stop doing it. And I get it, and I don't fault them for that, but it makes me concerned as to, you know, particularly having gone through the speculator boom and bust in the 90s, where things were getting built up, there was the hologram covers, the foil covers, the die-cut covers, all that kind of shenanigans. And then the bust came, people realized it wasn't going to pay for their kids' college in 20 years or whatever. They got upset, they bailed out of the market, and suddenly, you know, shops were closing up left, right, and center. So there's a precedent for this happening in the past. The question is, are the publishers got a game plan if that happens again?
Right.
And I think that's a concern regardless of a worldwide pandemic. And I think adding one that's having a severe economic impact too, that's a dangerous combination. What else do we have up here near the top of the list?
Just to be clear, John, on the top of the list, the Batmans, the ones that are up there are the A covers, the $4.99 covers are farther down, and those numbers have not been added together, correct?
Correct. I have not changed the system to do that yet.
So the actual sales for those are in the 70, low 74, mid 73,000, somewhere in that range. So the Batmans would have actually slotted in 4th and 5th this month.
Yeah, just below the X-Men.
Yep.
But still,
it oddly enough does not change the top 10 because they were 8th and 10th respectively. But
yeah, yeah.
And that's a number we know is going to go screaming up the charts with Punchline and the Designer and all of that fun. Once we hit Batman 90, numbers started going up. Batman 92, we're going to see a huge spike looking forward. So this is a book that's clearly going to rebound.
Good. That's good to hear.
It's going to rebound for character reasons, not cover reasons as well.
That's even better. If it's got story content reasons, I'm always in favor of that. Because, I mean, the title's below 75,000, and the Batman title for a long time had sustained over the 100,000 mark. So it's got room it can grow back up to.
Yeah, and I think that 100,000 was a couple of different things. Obviously, for the bulk of that run, it was $2.99. It was monthly, and Was there a team in comics during the New 52 era that was hotter than Snyder and Capullo?
Not that I can think of.
So, I mean, it was like a trifecta of good things going on from there. But, I mean, to your point, though, there's a reason that Batman is the benchmark every month for the rankings, right? It's supposed to be one of the most stable ongoing, if not the most stable ongoing title. So, you know, hopefully we see that performance continue to trend up after this initial buzz from the punchline and all of that good stuff. So we'll be looking after issue 92 to see if it carries through and see what it stays at.
Well, and hopefully that gives that title the boost it needs to where it can be kind of competing head-to-head with the X-Men. Because I think it'd be really good if both companies have kind of a flagship title that people are really excited about, it's selling really well, and then it's every month to see, you know, did X-Men do better than Batman? Did Batman do better than X-Men?
Yeah, and maybe it's something that we can look at the Immortal Hulk curve to see what this might look at. Because the first few issues of Immortal Hulk, even number one, wasn't a super big hit, but it dipped, you know, for those next couple of issues, and then all of a sudden some new characters. I think Immortal Hulk 4 was the first appearance of one of the new characters. And ever since then, it had a jump and then it sustained. And so it'd be interesting to kind of map out what that trend would look like percentage-wise on the numbers of Batman and see if we can predict where maybe it'll land.
Yeah, I just tossed together a quick chart of Immortal Hulk. It started close to 100,000 for total sales of that first thing, got to about, I don't know, 84,000. And then it was in the 54,000 range for a little bit, dipping down to almost 50,000 and back up to maybe, I don't know, 56,000. Then it was in the high 40,000s for about 5 months. Then it started climbing back up to about 55,000, 61 or 2,000 to above 90,000 for a bit. And it's funny because it's kind of arcing down with like a spike back in April, and then where it's been doing the last 5 months or whatever is really right around that upper 40 to lower 50,000 range that it had been doing kind of Q4 of 2018 and Q1 of 2019.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how that works because, yeah, it's at 49,545 this month. It'd be interesting to see if Batman follows a similar curve or if it, because of its flagship title status, gets a rebound and is able to sustain longer.
Yeah, I think if it's able to boost the sales, it's got a history that shows it has a good chance of hanging on to them. There's no guarantee of that, but if people say, ooh, I want to check out this new character, if that's enough to get them in the door, the story and the character is at least strong enough that it may keep them on the title for a little bit. So it would be nice to see that happen. And we've got a number one from DC in here. At rank 25, it is Green Lantern Season 2, number 1, 41,242 units. This is Grant Morrison. I think people kind of knew what they were getting into for this one, so I don't know if DC's happy with these sales or not. And I could see either way where they would or wouldn't be. Personally, I was enjoying what they'd been doing prior to Grant Morrison taking over the book, but other people are loving this, so, you know, there's that.
What was the Green Lantern title at before the season one Grant Morrison book? Is that something where it took a significant drop and maintained?
It bounced for an issue or two and went back to where it was.
Okay, so it kind of ended up about even.
Yeah.
I'm actually pulling up a chart, and the Green Lantern title that had been going on through the end of 2016 started way up with the start of the New 52 around, I don't know, 170,000, ended up around 33,000.
Well, go to Rebirth. We're talking about the one that was right before Grant Morrison.
It was not an actually called just Green Lantern singular. Was that Green Lanterns plural?
Oh, shoot. Was it?
That was Green Lanterns plural.
Okay. Yeah, that was with Simon Baz and Jessica Cruz.
That one started around 100,000 and then arced down to where it was getting in the 23 to 25,000 range, had a little bit of a bump and then back down. And then this new volume, or the one that started in 2018, the first volume of it, started around 116,000, but it dipped down to somewhere above 40,000, between 40 and 41,000. So it was doing better.
Yeah, it's about where it was either way.
That first season of the Grant Morrison stuff was doing better than the new 52, the Rebirth version, which generally was not doing as well as the new 52 version, which generally was not doing as well as the previous one, which had some high points and stuff during, you know, Blackest Night and things of that sort. But all of them follow pretty much the standard curve. Start at some high level, drop significantly on a second, again on the third, again on the fourth, and then kind of, you know, coast your way down until you get to kind of sort of a steady state, if the title lasts long enough for that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it's surprising how many titles just show up with the same basic kind of slope.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if they were to start a season three, it would start off strong, but typically would drop quite a bit, and we could see this below potentially 30,000 next month, based on how much the drop was on the first season of the Grant Morrison stuff. But we'll see what we see next month.
Right.
And then after that, all bets are off. I think we're in a period where normal sales trends that we've been seeing for years may or may not apply after, you know, comics resume shipping.
Yeah, I think it's all going to be dependent on what the decision is, how they decide to go about publishing. Are they going to do a straight up pause and then just hit a resume button? Are they going to start shifting schedules? I mean, we really haven't gotten a whole ton of detail on that stuff yet, obviously, because we're still, you know, fresh into what the heck is going on, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I think really the next major revelation on kind of how these comics are going to sell after the shutdown, we'll find out as we're recording this tomorrow morning when we look at Comixology and see what was actually released. Last I looked, it sounded like Marvel, DC, and Image had all decided not to release digital comics for what was going to be in print in stores, but won't be on the first.
Correct.
So if that holds true, I think that's a good sign, but we'll see how many other publishers stayed that way or went that way and how many didn't.
I think the most important thing out of all those announcements was DC saying they would explore book publishers.
But see, that's nothing new. They already do that.
Exactly. But if they focus there, unlike most comic fans, I have no great nostalgia, love, or affinity for the direct market. I just don't.
I'm not sure that anybody has a great love for it. I think we have a high tolerance and acceptance because it is fact.
Fair enough.
I don't know that many readers would say, yep, this, if we could decide how comics were distributed, this is what it would be. I don't believe that.
Yeah. And I've argued for years, the best thing for comics is to get more places, not fewer. And I realize a lot of comic people look at that and just think, oh my God, it's going to hurt my local comic store, which it probably would. But I didn't grow up going. I grew up going to 7-Elevens and Woolworths.
Yeah, but that's because you're like me and you're not young. Comics have been out of those places for decades.
I'm not quite as old as you, but that's not the point. I mean, that was the mid-80s and early 90s. We're not talking 50. I'm not talking the 50s here.
Well, neither am I. I'm not that old.
No, I know. You're talking about 10 years before me, though, right? You're talking more late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, thereabouts. But even so, yeah, it held into the 90s and stuff. But the point is that the direct market came about not to get things out of those places, but because they were getting pushed out of those places, they needed somewhere to go.
Somewhere, yeah. But again, I realize I'm unique. I don't have the collector's bug at all. I don't have the value bug at all.
You do have some of the completest bug, though.
I do have some of the completest bug. I'm not going to argue that. But
which does make you have some of the collector bug.
Well, okay, collector, yes, but not the collectible bug. Because, and again, part of the reason I'm not a fan of the direct market, when my first comic book experiences weren't, like I said, they were the spinner racks in different places. And when I finally got to a comic shop, there was the initial, oh my God, they've got everything. I will take one of all of them. And then it became the, oh yeah, but I realize these all say 85 cents on them, but this one's got a special cover. That one we feel we can get $4 for. And so that's where a lot of my dislike of the direct market comes from. To me, the direct market was never a place to just go get a monthly magazine at the cover price.
Then you had a very different experience than I had.
It was a place to be gouged when they did start disappearing from places like 7-Eleven and Woolworths.
Yeah, I had a very different experience. For me, certainly having the spinner rack like at the grocery store and stuff, you know, my mom would take us to go get groceries. She would do that. I'd head over to the spinner rack and I'd go flip through some stuff and go read some comics. That's how I got hooked on, you know, Legion of Superheroes, All-Star Squadron, Justice League, a ton of stuff. I lean towards DC because, you know, Super Friends, whatever. But once I discovered that there was more comics and they didn't have all the comics I might want, and there were stores that had them, that's when I started going to those stores. And they were few and far between to begin with till I found more, until I could, you know, drive and get to them myself or take the bus or what have you. But I don't know if I just got lucky with the local stores and there was not that kind of a price gouging. And they just had tons of stuff. I mean, I remember working there when they would have, in some cases, the last, you know, an issue, a copy of every issue of the last, you know, 8 to 10 months or whatever of Wonder Woman sitting on the rack.
Yep.
So I don't think, and again, this may just be the difference of, you know, 5-6 years.
Yeah.
But certainly if you associate the direct market with kind of the markup for the back issues or whatever, I can see where you would have a different vantage point than I do of this is where I could find all the comics versus having to hunt every 7-Eleven on the off chance it might have, you know, a copy of something.
Oh, yeah. And that's where my love of kind of at least single readable stories comes from, because in the early days, my collection had a lot of holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the spinner rack thing. It just, you had holes. But somehow it didn't matter and it worked out. Now you can't have a hole. It's not a matter of now that I have the resources to go find them, sure, but you literally can't have a hole anymore.
Well, back then, the stories, like to your point, were not entirely done in ones, but they were sold as self-contained units, and a story may continue. But if it did, they'd spend a little time at the beginning of the story getting you back up to speed in case you either missed that issue, never read that issue, or just couldn't remember it.
Exactly.
You know, and give you enough payoff, even if it was maybe a cliffhanger-ish kind of an ending, that you felt you got your 40 cents, 50 cents, 75 cents, dollars worth, or whatever you were paying at the time.
Yep.
You know, and there were stories that would go, you know, multiple issues, you know, the Judas Contract, the Great Darkness Saga, to name a few.
Yep.
But that's very different than today's storytelling style of Chapter 1, Chapter 2, Chapter 3, Chapter 4, Chapter 5, Chapter 6, boom, we're done. It's going to get collected to trade. And it's as if we're starting a new book on the next issue.
And I think it's hard to get newer people in with that, which now if your single volume becomes trades, figure out a way to get, and I realize the bookstores sounds ridiculous because they're kind of a thing of the past too, but they do exist to some degree. There's got to be a way to make that work. And I think more comics in more places is better for everybody, not fewer.
Conceptually, I completely agree with you. And I do think that's one of the potential advantages of digital. Because if back in the days when we would all go into the office, if you were in the office and somebody was talking, oh yeah, I love this movie or whatever, it's like, I'd like to read the comics it's based on or whatever, you can actually tell them, oh, you like the Captain America Civil War stuff? You should read Civil War. Or you liked Bucky, Winter Soldier. You want to go read these things.
Yep.
And half the time, if they really wanted to, they'd either, you know, hop on their computer. If they were subscribed to the Digital Comics Unlimited for Marvel, it's just to point out the issues. Okay, I've got it flagged. I'm good. You know? So with digital, there's a comic book store on everybody's phone to some degree. Now, it scratches a different itch than somebody who wants either that coffee table collector edition or a physical trade or comic to hold in their hands. And I'm not going to get into, is digital the future? Is print better? Different things for different people. It really doesn't matter if they're hooked on the story.
I agree with all of that. I just don't think, as somebody who is hooked on the stories, I have yet to figure out at this point what the single issues offer somebody who just wants the story.
Serialized installments on a regular basis versus feast and famine of get 6 issues twice a year.
Yeah, but they're serialized in a way that you're better off keeping them and reading them as a group anyways. If you read a lot, there's no way you can remember all of them by the time the next one comes out. I mean, I know you've run into some of that, John.
Oh, absolutely. But to me, that's a failing of the storytelling, not of the packaging.
And I would say that part of the impetus behind the single issues, whether it's a single done in one story or a portion of a story arc, if it's written well, it can generate a lot of buzz, a lot of word of mouth, and keep people excited that otherwise in a 6-month lull would probably drop off. So it's an important marketing vehicle as well.
Well, yeah, it sustains the momentum, because how many times has something hit big on Netflix, everybody's talking about it for a week or two or three, maybe four or five if it's a huge hit, and then they're on to the next thing.
You do the trades, you do see some impact on that stuff. Not as much as we'd like, but you do see some.
We're seeing a general softening on sales on the trade side just in general.
Yeah, and again, part of that could be the direct market, but generally when a movie comes out, you see some effect on those trades.
To me, it falls into two different categories of properties. When you've got something like Watchmen or 300 or something, maybe even Umbrella Academy, and I'd have to double check the numbers to see if that holds true or not, but something where there is a single trade to go to. You like this, that's the book you're going to buy. Then you'll see a show on the numbers. You could have something that is crazy successful, be it the Marvel Cinematic movies, the CWDC shows, or something like that, where it's, you know what, I'm really excited about this character or team, but there's no particular trade that's the recipient of that. It may just get dispersed over, you know, oh, maybe the Flash books are doing a little better than they would otherwise, or not. So I think where we really see that direct impact is when there is a singular book that everybody decides to go pick up because it's such a either a clear adaptation of a particular volume or something, or there's a clear connection from whatever that movie or TV show or whatever is to that volume. And I think in most cases, because they're pulling at so many threads at once from so many different things and inspired by the greater body of work for Daredevil, for the X-Men, for Batwoman or Flash or Arrow or you know, whatever, there's not a single trade that suddenly shoots up the charts or something. And I think the reality is, and maybe this will change with the pandemic and people being at home more, people just, as Americans, we're not readers. I mean, we, I think, on the call are, and I think our listeners are as well, but the average American, I don't think so.
Right.
Everyone says that, and I don't necessarily disagree with the statement as a whole, but there's a large enough market.
There's certainly a larger market than comics have tapped into.
Yeah, I gotta say, there are some very, very successful novels out there.
Mm-hmm.
They're selling those books to somebody.
Yep, but I think those really successful novelists are selling it to the casual fans that may read a book or two a year, and those are the books they're reading. And I think there's a contingent of people that are avid readers and read more than a book or two a year.
Okay, but what would be wrong with if there was a large group of comic fans that read a collected edition or two a year? That would be a great thing, wouldn't it?
I would argue that's already happening, and we still have sluggish sales. Now, if we could get the average American that only reads a thing or two a year to go read a collected edition of comics, sure, that'd be an awesome thing.
Fair enough.
I mean, it comes down to, we really need like 0.5% of the people that go see one of these, you know, Marvel movies to go buy any particular trade, and we would see that do really well in the direct market if they chose to get it through the direct market. Now, realistically, if they were going to go do it, they'd probably just go find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or something like that, so we wouldn't see the numbers through here.
Well, and as someone who used to have to travel for work, and Eric is someone who was traveling probably as recently as a few weeks ago for work, you do see those Hudson News. And again, we're talking about the really successful. How many? There's 5 or 6 names that make up 90% of those paperbacks you see in those stores in the airports. And to be fair, when you're sitting on an airplane and you see what people are reading, it's again 7 or 8 of those same novels. If there was a way to get comic books there, how great would that be?
Yeah, but from what I've heard of those bookstores in airports, that is a cutthroat competitive market.
Absolutely.
They basically, from what I've heard, start at, you know, one end of, say, LAX or whatever, and are stocking the stuff. And then by the time they circle back to the first place they're at, if the stuff hasn't sold, they're taking it out and putting a different book in there, kind of thing.
Yes.
So it's already favoring books that are widely successful.
Yes.
And then there's also a, there's nothing else to pick. I've got a 4-hour cross-country flight or transatlantic flight or whatever. I guess that's the best I can do. Whether it's really what I want or not, I need something. If you're actually, you know, stuck at an airport with no book and want a physical book versus these days, I would hope you have your Kindle or some other e-reader with you and can pick from whatever you've got available there.
I'm the anomaly. That's not me. I do not subscribe to e-readers. I can't stand them.
How come?
I stare at a screen all day. I have a cell phone that's constantly in use. The last thing I want to do is read off of a backlit digital screen or have to have some sort of battery-operated thingamajig that's losing its charge. My paper books never run out of battery.
That's totally fair. I can agree with all of that. You also don't have the problem I hit on my cruise at one point where it was as if my paperback evaporated in front of me and I had to re-download the thing. It was particularly annoying.
To that, though, I also don't go on extended trips where I need to pack a second suitcase for my reading material. So, you know, most of my trips are 3 to 5 days in duration. I can manage to fit 2 trades into whatever I'm taking with myself to read. So I guess for me, that's what it is. But I know, Sam, you have a different experience just based on how you travel. And you had talked in the past about how you like the size format of a lot of those pocketbooks where you can literally just slam it in a jacket pocket or even a pants pocket and just cruise along with it. And it's not even noticeable.
Yeah, I do. And with e-readers, I have a love-hate back and forth relationship. You know, I had the very first, when RCA made the first e-book, which you literally plugged into a telephone line to make a modem call to download the book on. And I've got a current Kindle, and I've had Nooks, and I'll go 6-8 months where that's the way I read all my books. Back the pocket books where I don't touch them for a year or two. So I understand kind of both sides of the e-reader dilemma. It is not my preferred format, but there are times where it's easy and convenient. It's the popular choice for a period of time for me.
I think if they were to come up with a device that approximated the size of a comic book and was a full color e-reader kind of a thing, had a good interface or whatever, that would help get some people switched over to digital that would otherwise just prefer the form factor and whatnot of print. It certainly would not get everybody. There's an aspect where you want that page flip and you want that tangible experience, and you want it not battery powered too sometimes. But I think it was the advent of devices like the Kindle that really kicked ebooks into high gear, and that's not something I feel we've got the equivalent for just yet on comics.
Yeah, the other thing with comics for me in a digital format is I've tried the Comixology app. I've tried the Marvel, before it was Marvel Unlimited, it was just Marvel and you had to enter your codes and stuff. And I tried that, and it was okay. Obviously, my prejudice towards having more electronic devices in my life, but the thing that I really hated was half the time it would go into some sort of guided view, and it just drove me nuts because I'm not the kind of person that can just singularly focus panel to panel to panel. I need to be able to see the whole page because usually there's more visual cues going on than just in one little, you know, 2x3 square. And that drove me nuts as well because I'm just one of those people where I need to see the big picture and be able to kind of like almost zoom in and out, and it just drove me nuts. I'm a crotchety old man, apparently.
Hey, Eric, I'm right there with you on that. I'm the same way. Every once in a while when I am reading digitally, particularly comic, and it goes into one of those weird guided views, I spend the next minute and a half trying to figure out, A, how I accidentally got there, and B, how to get out of it.
And cursing under your breath the whole time.
Exactly.
It's a matter of us being experienced comic book readers and not wanting to be kind of dragged by the nose or whatever. Yet I've talked to some people that are not as experienced, you know, comic book readers and sometimes get lost by the panel layouts and stuff like that of, well, where do I read next?
Well, so, to be fair, that happens to me still, too.
Oh, same here. But there are some people that have actually told me they really like the guided view experience in digital comics because it removes that ambiguity and confusion. Yeah. But that's the difference between we have more experience kind of navigating through that and some people don't. It's interesting, though, that because of the visual form of comics, that sort of thing was seen as a need or just developed for a variety of reasons, like, you know, again, a small screen size on a phone, whereas that kind of a problem just doesn't exist for a prose novel. You know, the words are the words. As long as you see them in the right order, you're good.
No, but I will say that they had a similar type of invention when they created, I don't know if it's the Nook, the Kindle, what it is, maybe it's all of them now, but there was, for the longest time, if you wanted to zoom in on the page, you literally zoomed in and then you had to drag your finger across to see side to side. And now they've got the one where you can zoom out and the words automatically readjust to the size of what you've made them. So you don't actually have to scroll side to side to read the rest of the line. Like, I think that's almost like the e-reader version of a guided view for comics.
Well, I'll admit, I've taken advantage that the Kindle I've got, I can bump up the font size. But to me, that while that changes how the words are laid out on the screen, the layout on the screen, if it breaks on the third word or the eighth word, it kind of doesn't matter, you know, whereas...
Agreed.
To your point, if you're focusing on one panel and not seeing the full page, I mean, imagine some of the stuff that J.H. Williams had done on Batwoman, where you'd have these two-page spreads and the panels kind of formed a big bat logo and some stuff like that. You lose that entirely if you're going, you know, inset panel by inset panel.
That being said, you can read the 12 inset panels and be done with it. I remember staring at those pages for 6 minutes, reading it four different ways, trying to figure out what the right way was.
Yes. Again, I've hit those pages where do I go left? Do I go down? What do I start in the middle and work out? Do I start at the out and work in? I mean, what am I doing here? But to me, that's page artists, layout artists getting a little more experimental than maybe they should.
Yeah, and I can think of two titles that I had tried reading digitally that just were an abomination. One was the New 52 Grayson, and the reason that one was so bad was because it was a book that had frequent double splash pages or even just single splash pages where you'd see Dick moving through the air, you know, doing some sort of acrobatic maneuver, and you're following him as he's going, and you're not even getting like sound effects. You're actually getting either internal monologue or dialogue, and with the guided view, it's like jumping all across and you miss the entire beautifulness of the art and the story that's being told through that. The other one was Allred and Slott's Silver Surfer. There was just so much going on the pages, so much beautiful art that you miss story cues and pieces when you're just going panel to panel, especially the issue that circled back on itself. And if you didn't, you could get caught in an endless loop if you were reading the book. And if you had the digital reader, it just skipped right past that and you didn't even realize it. It was just like, didn't matter because it just moved you to the next panel. So you kind of lost some of the joy and the fun of it.
Yeah, I that was when you were mentioning the Silver Surfer one. That was the one that came to mind of just some of the stuff they were doing with the visual storytelling style. You lose going panel to panel. I do think, though, with people being stuck at home and everything having gone day and date digital for, you know, almost a decade now, there's a wealth of material out there. This is an opportunity for these publishers to really go after that segment of our population that is interested in these kinds of characters, as witnessed by the success of the movies and the TV shows, is willing to actually read. We just need to help them find the right digital comics and stuff, and hopefully in a way that we can then transition them when, you know, everything's up and going again after the, you know, slowdown and stuff for the pandemic and stuff. That gets them into comic stores and enjoying the print and tangible side of the hobby. And in addition to the books, the trades, the comics, you know, the toys and other, you know, the t-shirts and stuff like that, too. So I'm a little disappointed is not the right word, but I think it was a missed opportunity that some of these publishers have overlooked in expanding their readership. Even if it was just a, hey, we'll give you some free codes to go get, you know, the first issue of the Dawn of X stuff so people would be interested in the later stuff, or I don't know, something. You know, I think there's a way to tap into a larger audience now, particularly one that may be hungry for things to do as sports have shut down, TV shows have shut down, and things like that. I don't see the industry having really taken advantage of that potential opportunity.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be a long time to get back to normal with some of that stuff. It's going to be over a year to really see the impact on things like television and movies. Again, I know I saw something, I think the president of AMC Theaters today said that he hoped movie theaters would be open by the middle of June, and he thinks the movie-going audience will be thrilled and excited to go back to the theaters. And well, I don't disagree with him. There's going to be a year and a half and not much out there and very weird release schedules. And it's going to take a long time for some of that stuff to go back to normal, even if you could snap your fingers and end it tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah. Just to pick back up the production schedules and stuff like that and straighten out how to release it and all that. You're right. That would take a while. Along those lines, let's jump down to ranks 236 and 269. From Valiant Entertainment, we got Bloodshot number 0 having done 6,824, and then Bloodshot number 6 having done 5,640. The reason I brought these up is movies and stuff. This whole shutdown timed kind of really badly for what could have been the start, and may still be the start, of a Valiant cinematic universe with Bloodshot.
Well, it didn't do any favors to DC's Harley Quinn or Birds of Prey movie as well, because that didn't do so well in America, and when it went to China was about, I think, 4 days before they started shutting theaters down there.
I would argue the DC movies have had a rocky enough road that it wasn't starting the trend that way, whereas this is the first Valiant movie.
Okay,
yeah.
Couple of things. Because I've seen both the films, and this isn't a movie review show.
No, and I have seen neither, so please don't spoil, but yes.
I'm not going to spoil.
I know.
Harley Quinn, A, is not nearly as bad as some people would have you believe, and B, it didn't do nearly as poorly as there's a group of people that really want people to think this movie absolutely bombed. This was no John Carter.
Well, it wasn't an absolute bomb.
It was fine. This was a movie that came out in February. It did just fine. It did well. You know, it was certainly no hit, but it was to the point of doing well. So the idea that it somehow was this colossal failure is insane. Bloodshot, I really like Vin Diesel. He's not a great actor, but I like him. What can I say? That, unfortunately, is not a great film. I hope it does well. It's just a very questionable thing.
So you think potentially the timing of its release versus the pandemic and theaters and stuff like that kind of having to shut down, I don't want to say works in its benefit, but is a viable excuse of, well, you know, if it wasn't for the pandemic, and they can kind of sweep that under the rug and do another better Valiant film?
Yes. Unlike Harley Quinn, no one's going on and on about how Bloodshot bombed when I would argue it is a far worse film.
Interesting. Because I know they'd been talking about doing the films for Valiant for quite some time. They were finally getting it out and stuff. Whether it was going to become the next Marvel Cinematic Universe or not, I think that's unlikely just because the Marvel one has been so crazy successful, but also was built on decades worth of material. Valiant's library just isn't as comparatively deep.
Well, and let's face it, DC has a library similar in scope and potential as Marvel, and it can't even do as well.
True, true.
Again, do as well is relatively questionable. As well, no, but other than possibly Star Wars, and even that's questionable, nothing is done as well.
Right.
But Justice League made a fortune. We're not, again, people loved it. Oh, no, it didn't. It did really, really well.
There's how it's doing financially, but then how it's doing kind of in the court of public opinion. And in the circles I travel in here locally and such, when people are talking about movies, if it's positive, it's a Marvel movie. If it's negative, it's a DC movie. And they associate the negativity in the DC as being just one and the same. It's never going to change in their mind. I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. And there's a lot of... I'm odd. I enjoyed the Justice League film. But I went with a friend who's not a comic book person, and they enjoyed it. I know a lot of people that saw it. I know a lot of people that own it. I know a lot of kids that have the DVDs. $657 million. No, that's not Endgame. But again, not a disaster by any stretch. Not even bad.
True, true. But I think a lot of people are looking at how the Marvel movies do financially and in terms of their own enjoyment and comparing the DC ones, you know, against that, which I think is an unfair benchmark because DC's not as many movies into the sequence as Marvel has gotten.
Well, and they are and they aren't. I've got plenty of issues with the DC films, but they're not this colossal failure that so many, particularly the comic book fans, want to paint them as. Yeah, no, they're not as far. That being said, we've gone through three world universe-ending events in 2.5 films, so they treated it differently than Marvel.
Yes, yes, they did. Marvel, I think, earned their success and stuff, whereas the DC films, I think, were just a little impatient. Tried to get there too fast. But I think those are the touchstones most people have, or those movies, the TV shows and such, that if we're going to try to get them into comics and stuff, and I think, again, there's an opportunity to do that, are the comics going to be similar enough to the mass media they've seen in the movies and TV to make that transition? And are they going to think well enough of those movies and TV shows to give the comics a shot? And that's where I think things get a little dicey. So what other comics looked interesting to you guys on this list?
John, I see you've got some stuff from Marvel highlighted in yellow, and I presume that is because the retail rank was way off compared to quantity ranks. And I checked those out, and those were books that Marvel did free promotional percentage increases on. Some were 50%, some were 100%, but those are just ones that they gave us some extras to, I think, help move potentially. A lot of them are number twos, a couple of number ones, and it's really just keep the books on the shelf, keep people's interest and whatnot. So I don't know if that was highlighted for me to answer those, or if it just happened to be one of those things where they showed up yellow and that was that.
It was one of those things where, as I was going through, it's like, these retail ranks look a little weird, so, you know, I'll highlight those. Because otherwise, when we're talking about it, I just gloss over that and don't always see it. I assume star number 2 at rank 39 was one of those?
Yep, I think that was one as well.
Because that was down almost 40% even with that kind of promotional push.
Yep.
So that's a little unfortunate for them.
Well, that was one we talked about last month that led off with all sorts of big creator covers and high ratio variants, and it was riding the high of the new character status. So that was kind of almost an inevitable.
Yeah, but given how much buzz there was around this character, I would have expected it to do a little better than 35,000 units on the second issue.
Well, let's just real quick here, going to look up Captain Marvel, because where that book lives is at 30,579, and this is a character that spun out of that. So to expect it to be higher on an ongoing basis, I think, is maybe a little bit weak considering the short duration of which she's existed.
I think I'd been hearing more people talk about Star than Captain Marvel, though.
Yeah, buzz about a new first appearance is definitely going to take a lot more attention than an ongoing title. But
fair.
Again, she'd appeared like a handful of times in the Captain Marvel title, so it's not like she was fresh. And again, all those variant covers propped up the numbers.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if this is a book we see kind of living around that 15 to 18,000 mark.
That makes sense. I'm wondering how fast it'll drop because it's only 5 issues or 6 issues? 5, I think.
Yeah, I think it's 5. And I would say it's going to drop pretty quick because I don't think we're getting any free copies for the next one.
That would do it.
Right. One thing about those free copies real quick. Someone asked me in passing, and I don't know if it was on the Slack channel or where it was or if an email, but they had asked if free promotional copies count towards ratio variants. So the answer to that is no, they don't. Whatever we buy up or order up front, that's what we get. So if we get, you know, 50 and we get the 1 in 50 and a 1 in 25 and then Marvel doubles our order, we don't get another 1 in 50 and 2 more 1 in 25s. We just get the extra 8 covers. So if anyone out there was wondering, that's how it works.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Because, I mean, you're making more money off the variant covers and stuff, and they're trying to gain readers, not give away free stuff with the extra copies.
Yep.
Or not, you know, high-ticket items, you know what I mean.
Yep.
What is your take on the sales for Leviathan Dawn down at rank 59 of 28,149?
I think what we're looking at with Leviathan Dawn is Leviathan had great reception, but every time you do an add-on, it seems to just kind of be a little bit less than the original. I think that they would have been better off if they just had kept Leviathan as an ongoing title and done like a subtitle for the next trade arc, essentially. Because now we've got the same thing with Deceased Unkillables. The thing propping that up is going to be the additional third and or fourth covers that they're doing as opposed to the title itself. I mean, it's a great title, but covers are propping that one up.
Not having read Deceased, is Unkillables a sequel to Deceased or a direct continuation of an unfinished story from the first miniseries?
I couldn't tell you. I read Deceased. I have not read Deceased Unkillables personally. I don't know.
Okay.
I'd love to tell you, but I'm just going to be honest and say I don't know.
Because, like, we talked about the Batman White Knight stuff and Curse of the White Knight, how that was essentially a sequel to the first story, not just they left it unfinished.
Right.
Whereas with Leviathan, Event Leviathan, they left that unfinished to go into Leviathan Dawn, which left unfinished, it's going to go into the Leviathan Checkmate or whatever it is.
Yep.
And I think the string of titles like that, that I think people get really tired of that pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think it gets to be exhausting. I mean, you can do it if you're only doing it with one title, I think, in a big line. But when you do it with multiple titles, it just starts to get a little, I guess, maybe a little bit exhausting.
Well, and I know I've mentioned this more than once, but the whole Agents of Atlas going into the Atlantis attacks.
Yeah, that was a hard left that not a lot of people could follow.
Well, and I don't think they solicited the Atlantis attacks one as a continuation of it. Otherwise, I might have considered getting it. But they did that, and they saw a bump in sales on how those issues have done over where the Agents of Atlas stuff had left off.
Yep.
I mean, because that title had left off under 10,000, and we're seeing Atlantis attacks here at, what, 24,125 units. So changing up the packaging worked to their benefit, but that's not the least bit surprising. I'm sure that's entirely why they did it.
I would assume so.
It just seems like Leviathan, Action Comics, and some of the other stuff that Bendis is doing, while I'm enjoying it immensely, it's not, you know, lighting up the sales charts. It's not doing horrible either. They're still well within the top 100 and stuff.
Right.
But I could see where they might have hoped for a little bit better reception on that material.
I'm going to say, interestingly, if we move down the list, once again, the top non-DC Marvel book is Spawn, and it actually went up this month at rank 38. Got a small increase of almost a little over 1,000 units, actually.
Yeah, I think it was able to leverage the excitement around the issue 300 and 301 to really kind of re-energize its readership, and I think it's great that it's doing that.
Yeah, and there's a D cover on this. Most of them just had A, Bs, and Cs, so I think we can attribute some of the increase to having a fourth cover, and that fourth cover also for a little while was going for between $20 and $30 on the secondary market just because of the, it was an FOC ad, I believe, lower print run, and it was a desirable cover, so.
Yep. And rank 55 is the next non-Marvel DC book and the top Boom book in Rangers. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, number 3 at 28,853. So again, nice to see that doing well, but that is a pretty healthy drop of close to 10% from its previous issue.
And if you go down to 85, the 85th item, we have IDW's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Genica with their first issue.
Yep.
Which I think 21,317 on a first issue launch of a new character that was pretty hot. You know, I would say that's probably a disappointment.
Well, it was a $5 book.
Well, as Marvel has shown us, that really doesn't matter.
But it outsold TMNT 103. And the Genica one was the top-selling IDW book.
Yeah, I don't dispute any of that. I just feel like they were probably hoping for better.
Fair enough.
Well, it was a hot character-ish for a new turtle, but one Peter Laird has, for 30 years, screamed about not existing. So old Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle fans aren't that excited about it.
Between the Power Rangers TMNT and the TMNT Genica one, there was also Undiscovered Country from Image with its fourth issue doing 24,034 units.
And is that Red Sonja, rank 95, Dynamite's top book at Age of Chaos number 2 at 8,586?
Yes, beating out Vampirella number 8, which did 17,003 units, also by Dynamite.
Is there anybody we forgot? Dark Horse. Is there a Dark Horse book on this list?
Yeah, Stranger Things, Into the Fire, number 2 at rank 152 with 11,424 units, which beat out...
And Bang, issue 1. Yeah, beat out Hellboy, issue 1. Bang.
I was going to say Hellboy and BPRD at rank 156 was the second best Dark Horse. I did read Bang, number 1, and enjoyed it. I'm curious what people are going to think when it gets collected in trade. This seems like one that in some respects may read better in trade, in some respects may read worse in trade. I just don't know yet. I've only read the first two issues.
Funny, we were talking about the Bloodshot film. Reading the solicit, it kind of sort of sounded like he was almost a Bloodshot-ish character meets a James Bond-ish character.
For Bang?
Yeah.
That was kind of sort of what I thought about the first issue, and I think the second issue I felt differently on. I don't want to spoil.
Fair enough.
It's one of them that I didn't dislike the second issue either, but it's going to be interesting to see how the miniseries pulls together at the end.
Again, for explanation's sake, I'm assuming the Dark Horse Predator Hunters 3, rank 266 and 294, Is that like DC with the same book with two different cover prices?
Yes. If you look at the quantity rank column, you'll see that it's grayed out.
Grayed out, yeah.
If you expand columns B and stuff, you'll see the full sales stuff.
Got it.
At some point, I will try to get this to where it condenses those down and just puts them where the total sales would be. I just have not had time to do that. That's a fairly significant shift to the entire kind of structure of my number crunching process. But one that's, I think, increasingly needed, just given how many of these things fall into that kind of a category of having multiple price points and multiple items listed for it. You know, if we get to the bottom of the top 300, we're just below 4,000 units with 3,995 units. We jump down to the bottom of the top 500, and we're down at 777 units. We can definitely see how some of the stuff is just softening up pretty quickly as we go further down the list. That's nothing new, but I do think we're starting to see a little bit lower in some areas where things are averaging than where they used to be. But by the time we're out of the top 15, we're well below, 50,000 units. And again, some of that is just, hey, second month of the year, not a strong month. I think there's a little bit more to it than that, too. And of course, it shifts a bit once we factor in some of these things that had the different price points and stuff like that. And we're listed multiple times on the list. So I don't think that these sales are indicative of a market that's just crashing or anything. I don't think they're indicative of great success either. The fact the month was down a little bit, again, par for the course for this time of year. But if we look at where we're at, again, this is, other than about a year ago, the lowest sales have been in the better part of a decade. Now, we've seen things go down and then bounce right back up. I don't know that we're going to see that this time, just given the pandemic, the suspension of comics in April, and things like that. We're going to have a gap in the data, probably, for April. It just comes back to how soon do they ramp up, how successfully do they ramp up, and are there things that they could do to, make that a smoother process to have a better shot of success. And I think anybody who's got a snap answer to that is probably going to be a little bit wrong, because it's a complicated problem with some stores going to need a little bit more time to ramp back up, depending how hard hit their community was, and others possibly still not even really having felt the effect of the pandemic, but maybe have felt the effect of printers shutting down, Diamond suspending new sales, and things like that.
Right.
Wow. I forgot how expensive books were getting.
And what makes you say that? Not that you're the least bit wrong. You're totally right.
I'm just looking at the breakdown by price point. 23%. We're almost at a quarter of the books are over $4.
Yeah, but 72% of them are at $3.99 for the top 300.
Yeah, well, again, it's not the 72% that bothers, or the, what do we got here? 5% lower. It's the fact that the above is now 23%. There's 56 $5 books on this list.
Yeah.
Call it 57 because there's the one that's like 470, so fine. They tried to get cute with the price point.
Yeah, I think the number of 499 and over books, on the one hand, feels a little excessive, but when your default price point is 399, anything that's a least bit oversized or an annual or something like that is going to be at least $4.99. So to me, I don't know if the percentage that is at that $4.99 is disproportionate to back when we'd have like a $2.99 regular issue and a $3.99 annual or something. I'd have to go look that up. I just don't know off the top of my head. We're definitely seeing a consolidation of price points, because really, once you get past $3.99, $4.99, and $1, there's not many that have more than an item or two. Really, $5.99 has seven items, and it's one of the more common price points.
Well, and again, but that's the disturbing part. $5.99 and up, there's one less of those than there are the dollar ones.
Again, that doesn't particularly surprise me.
Yeah, there are 12 books, $6 or more, and there's 13 dollar issues. And just the two left at $2.99. I know what one of them is. What's the other?
I was going to say, which two are those? I'm curious. It is...
Well, Spawn's the easy one. I'm trying to find the other one.
Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? And then in the top 500, Archie and Friends, Winter Wonderland.
Okay.
I mean, $3.99 is the default price point.
I'm frankly a little surprised that we had three at $2.99 if we look at the full list. Really, all the dollar books are either the True Believers or the dollar comic stuff from DC. Those are all strictly reprints and such. So the minute you try to do anything a little larger than average, you're at least at $4.99. If you're trying to do something significantly larger, like one of these 80-page giants for an anniversary issue or something like that, that's when you start to get to the $7.99 or maybe even the $9.99. But, I mean, we've also had titles that are issues at that price point for many, many years now. Not often, but, you know, when, like, once a quarter, Deadpool would do kind of the oversized issue, it would often be $9.99 or something like that. It'd be, you know, four times the size or something.
I wonder if this is the first time we're really seeing a lower price point significantly helpable. Not only did Spawn 300 kind of shine a spotlight on it, and it certainly was not a cheap book, and neither was 301, but it did bring people back to the book, and they all went, oh, wait a minute, this is the one $3 book still left.
So the interesting thing about Spawn is most of the Spawn buyers that we have in our store and that I have on mail order are not just buying one copy. They're buying every cover. And 300 and 301 had, well, 300 had like 12 covers.
Yeah, forget those.
So, well, I'm just saying you can't forget those in this case because there's more of them that I see that are buying every cover than are not, which is different than, say, a Batman or a Detective where people are tending to buy one cover. So this is one where the multiple covers, I think, benefit it greatly.
But it's also where the lower price point benefits it because it makes it possible for them to buy all those covers.
Exactly.
They'd buy it anyways, because if they bought the 12 covers at $7.99 or whatever it was for 300,
fair enough.
You could raise the price to $3.99 for the three covers they get now, and they'd buy it.
But that's why I was gonna say 300 and 301 different. But yeah, I mean it's basically been a $2.99 book forever. So.
I don't know that the $2.99 price point on Spawn is helping it with sales. I think it's obviously not hurting it. So in that respect, it's a good thing. But you could equally make an argument that he's leaving money on the table if he were to go to the standard price point of $3.99. He would make more money. The question is, what kind of sales hit would he take for that? I think it's good not to do that. I think stay there, have kind of the promotional and moral high ground of the cheapest price point out there. That's just a smart move for a number of reasons.
But what I was saying is, I mean, how many anniversary bumps do we see, and how many of them hold at all? This one is held more than most I can think of.
Yep, and that's what I led with when we started talking with it, is he's been able to capitalize on the excitement and interest in 300 and 301.
Yeah, it could be for a myriad of reasons, and I'm just suggesting one of them might be the price point. It could have nothing to do with it as well.
I guess my take is he was able to capitalize on it, and the lower price point made that easier to capitalize on.
Yeah.
I don't think people were saying, well, you know, I wasn't going to get it, but it's $2.99, so I will. I think it's not even something they thought about. Whereas if it had been $3.99, probably still wouldn't have thought about it, might not have had quite the success. If it was $4.99, then people would have started thinking about it and would not have had quite the success. In other words, a higher price point than average is negative.
I just think that this is a title that it doesn't matter.
Okay, so what is the increase from the 280s to here because of? You think it's all the story?
I think it's all the story. And that's also when they started adding second, third, and fourth covers. Like, they didn't have all the additional covers in the 260s, 270s. They started adding those in the closer they got to 300. So I think it's, again, you're capitalizing on the same people. And you could market at $12.99, and a lot of them would still buy it because the Spawn fanatics are incredibly passionate about Spawn, and they will buy it. They may begrudgingly buy it, but they will buy it because they want that complete set. So this is just a book where, and the discussion about, you know, $2.99. Let's be honest. You know, Todd McFarlane's estimated net worth is $300 million. He doesn't need the extra dollar per book, and he's also one of those guys who looks for every possible marketing angle he can get because he's smart. He's the first independent comic to go longer than 300 issues, right? He's going to probably use a marketing tagline somewhere of the last guy to hold $2.99.
Yeah, he should.
Right. I mean, it's just who he is. And so he doesn't need the money. He doesn't really care. Everything that comes out is gravy for him at this point. So I think that, you know, let's just be real. It's a unique, it's a unicorn in the world of comics. And sadly enough, we have a lot of unicorns, but this is one where the price I don't think really matters. It doesn't matter how many covers there are. The more covers you throw at it, the more covers people are going to buy. So that's just my experience with it, both dealing with the mail order with our in-store and with people who have purchased things through our eBay store and stuff like that. Because like we had some of the ratios, and we'd put them up on eBay if they didn't sell in the store after a couple of weeks. We'd put them up on eBay, and people would email us through or message us through eBay constantly saying, do you have the full set? I just want the full set of covers. I'll buy this one, and I want the rest of them too.
Well, I think what we may discover over the course of this year is it's going to make a difference as to how the sales are built up with something like what you're suggesting with Spawn, where you've got a very loyal following of potentially fewer people than we see sales because they're buying the multiple covers and stuff. That's going to have one sales dynamic versus a title, say, that was selling the exact same numbers, you know, issue in, issue out as Spawn, but every person was buying just one cover or one copy.
Right.
Do you think the increase from the 260s to now is just the same group of people with more of them buying multiple covers?
Well, there are some people that jumped on to buy 300 and 301, but I think a good portion of it is the same buyers buying more covers. I mean, the only way to really test my theory would be to go down to one cover and see what the numbers do.
Sure.
And that would tell us. But I don't happen to have Todd's phone number handy, so if either of you do, feel free to give him a call and tell him that I'd like to run an experiment.
Like, even if we called him, he probably wouldn't run that experiment.
and that's a perfectly viable possibility. I mean, that would explain it as well.
But that's also something that if point of sales information across the nation was being collected, you could test the theory that way too. If the point of sales thing was tracking who was buying, you know, which item, and it was down to the variant level.
Yeah,
you wouldn't even need that. You just need purchases per transaction. I'm sure the average checkout would be one copy of the, you know, you'd probably see average at like 1.1 something. For most books, and maybe if this one was at 1.8, you'd go, oh, that does explain it.
Well, it comes down to having data that I at least don't have access to know, you know, if somebody got a cover of Spawn, did they get all covers of Spawn?
I'm just saying you wouldn't even need the variant information. You'd just need the register, and you just need the transaction.
At least down to they got multiple copies of Spawn.
Exactly.
Okay, so at least down to the issue level, if not the variant level.
Exactly.
But then we would know they got, you know, two, but maybe there were three available. So, I mean, bottom line is we need a little more information than we've got, but there's multiple ways we could kind of go chase this.
Yeah.
The point I was trying to drive to earlier is the relevance of this kind of purchasing dynamic and how it's broken down, I think, is going to matter as we're seeing an economic downturn, and there are going to be certain people that can't continue their regular buying habits, maybe can't continue their buying habits at all. And is that going to be something that impacts, you know, for each person impacted, one sale of a title or all the sales of all the variants for that title that month? In other words, one person losing their job or not being able to afford comics could have a bigger impact on Spawn than that same person's loss of a job or being able to buy comics would have on, say, Batman or X-Men, if they're just getting the one copy and not all the variants.
Yeah, that is certainly possible.
So, and I don't know what the, I don't say what the average reader does, because I'm not sure there is such a thing. I don't know how that risk is spread across different titles, only that those that are not as reliant on variant cover sales are in a little bit better position potentially to weather the storm if all content were equal. Now, we know all content is not equal. Certain things are just way more popular and liked better than other things, but I think you're better off doing it based on the quality of content than the plethora of cover gimmicks. So I'm hoping we will get the March data in the next 2 weeks or so from Diamond, but they're already working from home. I don't know how big of an impact that may or may not have on releasing data like the March sales. But I think when we get to there, we'll start also taking a closer look at the first ship dates and when things were solicited and when they went through the final order cutoff, because I think things that were released on March 4th had a better chance of doing well than something released on March 25th. So we'll see how that all plays out. Certainly, if our listeners have any questions and things they want us to look at with the March data in light of the pandemic and things like that, we've got Slack, they can always post on the forum or email me directly, and we'll try to include those questions in the episode. So you guys got anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think I'm good.
I'm good.
Well, with that, we'll call it an episode. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify that you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes two decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25 or SKUs and items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is voiding the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.